Hoy, Mets fans. Welcome back to Amazing Avenue Audio, the show. My name is Brian. With me, as always, is Chris. And, Chris, we are recording this shortly after the Mets 4-1 victory, it wound up being, right?
Yeah.
4-1 victory over the Cardinals. For some reason, I couldn't remember if one of the runs scored in the ninth inning, even though I watched it literally 10 minutes ago. 4-1 victory. That puts the Mets, they had a 4-3 road trip. We'll talk more about that in a few minutes. But the big news this week is that the Mets fired hitting coach Chili Davis and assistant hitting coach Tom Slater, and brought in two guys that were already in the organization, Hugh Quattlebaum as the hitting coach and Kevin Howard as the assistant hitting coach. Quattlebaum was the minor league director of hitting development, and Howard was the director of player development. Now, we'll talk about the new guys in a minute, but I know that the team was very, very upset with the dismissal of Davis and I guess primarily with Davis. I mean, I'm sure that Tom Slater was a well-liked guy, but it seemed like Chili Davis was really an important part of the Mets clubhouse. How do you feel about the Mets dismissing Chili Davis at this point in the season?
Not too strongly one way or the other, which I know is sort of the brand here for me, but a little more like, okay, it's weird. It's not on the same level in terms of, I'm not saying it's a mistake like this, but it almost goes back to the previous Mets front office saying, okay, we're going to bring Travis d'Arnaud, you know, we're tendering him a contract, going to bring him into the early season. Things don't go well in a short span of time, and then he's DFA'd. So I guess similar to that, it was just, I was a little surprised that they kept him on because, you know, we know he's well-liked by the players. We know that he had concerns about COVID and was coaching remotely last year, which, of course, unquestionably respect that decision. So we know they were looking forward to working with him in person again. But we also know that his philosophy on hitting and just the reputation that he had in his previous stints as a hitting coach in other organizations was one that didn't necessarily match up with slightly more modern front offices, which is most of the game now. You know, the Mets are finally under Steve Cohen beefing up that side of their baseball operation. So it was just a little weird that they brought him back. I think any hitting coach would have been vulnerable to being fired when the expectations are so drastically different from the results. You've got several hitters who we know are much better than this. You know, we've mentioned that James McCann maybe isn't. I think he's better than what he's done so far in 2021, but he might not be a great hitter, even relative to his position. But we know, and Conforto started to heat up. McNeil has a little bit too.
Alonso's looked right.
Yeah. Yeah. So, like, we know some of these guys have started coming around, but when you finish the first month of the year last in baseball and runs scored per game, despite all of the stop and go, even this week, the Mets had another rainout to deal with. And, you know, all things considered, it turned out okay. But there's a lot of things that were going on. Coaches have certainly been fired for less. So I guess I'm not – it didn't surprise me that there was a lot of reaction from big-time mainstream baseball media like, whoa, this is shocking, or, oh, the Mets butchered this or whatever, that kind of thing. I don't think it's anything on that level. I don't have any – like, I didn't necessarily want it. I would have been okay with staying the course for a longer period of time, but that's where I was on it. Did you feel any differently?
No, you know, the way I looked at it was that the Mets brought back the entire coaching staff from last year, more or less, right? They let it's a different bench coach, but I don't know if that was a team decision or a personal decision. But regardless, they let Luis Rojas stay manager. They let Jeremy Hefner stay a pitching coach. They let, you know, they left Chili Davis in his position. And I think that the idea was probably, look, these guys deserve another shot at this, because 2019, I think, went better than a lot of people expected for the Mets, especially on the hitting side. You know, you saw just, you know, Pete Alonso just rake as a rookie, and you saw Dom Smith start to really come alive. And so I think that they thought, all right, well, 2019 went well. 2020 was a season that it's hard to really judge anything that happened in 2020 as being abnormal or whatever, just because it's such a weird season. So you have to just kind of see it as a wash. So I think they've probably said, okay, let's let these guys give it a shot, but let's also make sure that our organization has the people in it that if they don't work out, it'll be relatively painless to put them in to elevate these people to new positions. I wonder if that was part of the conversation they even had when hiring Quattlebaum, to say, listen, you know, we're going to put you in this position for now, but know that if Chili doesn't work out, you're the first person we're going to consider for that job. I wouldn't be surprised if that wasn't part of the conversation. But who knows? It seems to me like you said, Chili Davis's approach is not exactly the most modern approach to hitting, but I also think that there is something to be said for a hitting coach that people on the team feel positively about. And I think that that might have even more of an impact on day-to-day baseball than a hitting coach's actual approach to things. You know, I don't want to diminish the role of the hitting coach, but there's a reason that you don't hear about superstar hitting coaches very often, because they kind of don't exist. I don't think a hitting coach can necessarily take somebody who is a Punch and Judy hitter and turn him into, you know, 1994 Barry Bonds or anything like that. You know, it's just these, you know, coaches can help within a certain range, but ultimately it's the talent of the players that determine how well a team does. And so do I think that firing Chili Davis is going to turn the Mets season around? No, I don't. And I think the short term shows that to be correct as well. It's not like a couple of days into the job, Quattlebaum was like, I've been watching tape and it's this simple, guys. Just do this and everything's fixed. That's not going to happen. And so I think that while it might be good to get some new voices into the mix, I'm not sure exactly how much of a difference the firing of Chili Davis is going to make over the course of the season. But I think if the organization is trying to establish a way of doing things, a sort of playbook for the organization from the top to the bottom, from the minor leagues on up, I think it's important that the major league staff sort of fits into that. And so if the team felt like, well, we're trying to develop this type of hitter, you know, we want this to be the quote Mets hitters, you know, this is the approach we want them to take, and if Davis wasn't a part of that, then I think that it makes absolute sense to get rid of him. I just don't know if this is the best time to do it.
Yeah. And I think we mentioned this recently too, but you just have that sort of unique relationship between a coach or any instructor and a player or any student, really, where sometimes it just clicks. And for somebody like a Justin Turner, who goes from league average hitter to incredibly good hitter, who knows if he doesn't make exactly every step in that path of his career, who knows if that ever ends up happening. So it's tough, I think, for any pitching coach or hitting coach. And I know pretty much it's become the standard that there's an assistant hitting coach and an assistant pitching coach. But I'd have to imagine it's tough for anyone in that role to click with everybody on a roster.
Sure.
And all of these guys have their off-season routines, and they all have people that they talk to that don't work for the team about what they're doing. So I don't know. seems like a lot, and I'm definitely not one to lean towards like, oh, this is information overload, but I'm surprised actually that like Keith hasn't talked a little bit more about that topic recently, because one thing we've heard a lot of is, oh, we didn't have a good plan for that pitcher. And then we didn't have a good plan for this pitcher. And you hear that a few times and you're like, okay, well, what if maybe you don't plan for the pitcher? Like, not saying, oh, we just totally wing it, but if the plans for the pitcher that you're facing aren't working routinely, they might not be good plans.
Right.
And you know, top to bottom, these are guys who, even McCann, at the very least, he's established that he's a major league player. It's not like he's somebody who you're on the verge of letting go. So overall, these are guys who know how to hit. So when I hear, okay, this plan didn't work, that plan didn't work, I kind of just want them to take a deep breath and just go up and focus on being themselves a little bit and sort of clearing things out and not worrying too much about what a guy does. Of course, you're going to have an idea of what pitches somebody throws going into a start. But other than that, I'd question extensive game planning if that process isn't working when they actually get out on the field.
See, I don't know if I question the game planning versus the game planner. Right, like maybe this is a case of the plans that Chili Davis was putting in front of the team just were not effective, and so maybe they need to have a new voice in there to get those more effective plans. I'm not saying that necessarily you're wrong in that maybe there was over preparation, but maybe, you know, maybe Chili was just not preparing the team well for the pitchers they were facing. And that seems to be the job of the hitting coach, right? To tell Pope, okay, you know, the guy you're facing today, his slider is wicked, but, you know, he has this little bit of a tell in his delivery, so make sure you avoid that. Just, you know, whatever the case may be, to help the hitters have the best approach to the plate. And if that guy is not helping them have the best approach to the plate, which he might be the nicest guy in the world, he wasn't helping them have better at-bats. He wasn't right now. I'm not saying he couldn't get them back there at some point, but right now, he was not helping the team have their best at-bats. And I think as long as you feel like you are in that you can win this division or you can make the playoffs, you know, as a wild card team, if you really truly believe that is the true talent level of your team, then what are you doing with a hitting coach who can't provide a winning game plan for your hitters? It just doesn't make sense to me. So I totally understand them getting rid of him. I was a little bit surprised to hear. I mean, I think Pete Alonso seems like a really good guy who probably has a lot of good relationships, so it doesn't surprise me that he and Chili were tight. I'm surprised to hear how apparently upset Lindor was over this. Lindor's known the guy for a couple months.
Yeah.
And the results with Chili Davis there were not very good for Lindor. So that's a bit surprising. But, yeah, that's about the extent of my Chili Davis thoughts. Do you have any more?
No, I think that's about it for me, too. I think this has a high probability of being something that everybody other than a couple Mets players forgets about by the end of the season.
Yes.
And that's no disrespect to anyone. I also, one other thing, too. I know when Pete spoke about it, he was very vocal and emotional. But it's sort of like this is his first major league coach in that role. And, you know, it's probably his first coach that he cared about who got fired. And that's going to happen. It's going to happen a few times. The nature of the job, you can be very successful and ultimately you'll probably get fired and not retire if you're a coach or a manager in Major League Baseball.
Yes. Yes. Excellent point. All right, well, let's talk about the Mets road trip. So we were saying before we recorded that the Mets wound up with a winning road trip. They won 4 games and lost 3. But if you're paying attention just the way that people talk about the Mets, and this isn't just the people we talk to who are, you know, the Amazing Avenue staff, among others, but this seemed like a disaster of a week for the Mets, and yet they're coming out of the road trip ahead. And they took 2 of 3 from Philly. They split the series with the Cardinals. And it seems like, yes, there were opportunities for the Mets to do more this week, but the team is not firing on all cylinders by any stretch, but they're still hanging in there and they're still doing all right. So based on the road trip, is there anything that you learned about this team? Do you feel better about anything? Do you feel worse about anything? Sort of what did the last 7 games kind of do for you?
Well, yeah, I mean, they've averaged more than 3 runs per game over this recent stretch, which is nice. The first half of the doubleheader, they scored 1 run, but every other game, they did more than that. You know, they scored 4 today. They scored 7 in the second game yesterday. They scored 5 on Monday when they lost. They scored 8 on Sunday, 5 on Saturday. And what did they do on Friday? Friday was a 2-1 loss. So twice in this road trip, they've had a 1-run game that was frustrating because they've consistently gotten people on base and they've consistently not hit well when they're there.
Yeah, they set a new team record today with 17 left on base in a 9-inning game.
Yeah, but, you know, overall, I continue to think that the offense will improve, will come around. Over the course of 162 games, I guess, you know, it's possible that you can hit that much worse with runners on base and runners in scoring position than you do in every other circumstance. But it's not likely, you know, even if they're an average offensive team, by the end of the season, they should probably have average looking numbers in all those situations. Right now, it doesn't feel that way. I don't know. They get these opportunities. I mean, today could have easily, with the way the Cardinals pitched, easily could have been a 10-11 run kind of affair.
Oh, yeah.
You know, one or two balls in the gap in multiple situations where there were you know, 2 men on or the bases loaded. And all of a sudden, you know, and especially when that kind of thing happens, it starts to feel contagious. You know, when you get those big hits, it often feels like other hits follow and the other team is just on the ropes and, you know, they really can't do anything and you're just turning the lineup over. That kind of thing is not happening. Yeah. You know, the Mets drove in one run, with contact, right. Officially, you know, the bases loaded walks or runs batted in. And I'm not one to complain. They won the game. You know, their pitching was still excellent. There's multiple components of a baseball team. So the fact that they got gifted a few runs by the Cardinals doesn't make it any less of a win to me. But yeah, they've established an abnormal sense of dread when there's 2 or more men on base and 0 out, 0 or 1 out in the inning. But at the same time, the more I see the bullpen, the more I feel like I was wrong to be so concerned about it. So that the bullpen wasn't perfect. You know, Castro had an outing, Diaz had an outing, that they struggled a little bit during this road trip. But the bullpen as a whole still had a very good week. And that's something that I think as the season goes on, you want to see that, okay, as a group, they can get into these high leverage spots. They're not always going to succeed. No bullpen does, no matter how good it is. But they can get into these spots. You know, most of their outings have still been very sharp. And then the Sunday night game, I thought, was a pretty good example. Diaz didn't have it. You know, barely gets away with not giving up the game-timing home run when it bounces off the rail and correctly was ruled on replay to have not been a home run. But, you know, he comes out of the game. They're still in a tight spot, and Jeurys Familia comes in and winds up getting the save. You know, Familia and Betances were both in the same boat for me coming into the season, primarily because they both had such significant walk issues recently. But Familia is, I don't know, he's looking fairly capable right now. And to see him come into that spot and not have that game turn into a loss, to hold on to win that series against the Phillies after a, you know, it's dramatic roller coaster inning was already underway, that was encouraging. So I think a little bit about, you know, the offense is more alive, even though it might not feel like it. And every week that goes by that the bullpen shows that it can be that kind of bullpen, just be effective, is another one that makes every tweet and piece that I had about my concerns about it look worse. And I hope that continues to happen.
Yeah, my one worry is that, you know, if by logic you say, well, it's 5 weeks into the season and the bullpen's looking better than I thought, I shouldn't have been so worried about the bullpen, then I think it's fair to also say it's 5 weeks into the season and the offense is much worse than I thought, I should be worried about the offense, right? Like, I feel like it's hard to find a way to believe both of those things to not be true if that's the logic that you're going by. I still think we're early enough into the season that the offense can pull up the nose pretty considerably. And I think that, you know, going back to the runners in scoring position for 1 second, I just think that when the team is hitting better in general, it will hit better with runners in scoring position. You know, the Mets are getting on base by walks and singles right now. There's very few extra base hits. There's very few balls hit with authority. When those things start happening, the runners in scoring position will happen. It will. I'm fairly confident in that position.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, I think that the pitching has been excellent. I mean, so, you know, the worst look of the week was Joey Lucchese on Monday. He really did not look like he had anything past the, I think it was the second inning he looked really good. The first inning he looked rough. The third inning he looked rough. But he looked good in the second inning. But, you know, guys like Sean Reed Foley have really stepped up and have looked very, very good for the Mets. Robert Gazelman has looked good in limited time played. You know, Jacob Barnes had a nice inning yesterday. Trevor May continues to be really good. The bullpen is really solid right now. And I think that the thing that maybe is getting lost because DeGrom missed the start this week, the Mets starting pitching has been overall still quite good. I know that Stroman had a rough go of it yesterday, but he should have been out of the inning where he gave up the two-run home run. But I think it was an error on Lindor's part, right? A throwing error from Lindor that continued the inning, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. The Lindor error in the first game of the doubleheader.
Yes.
That was around the point where I was like, okay, you know, maybe he should get a game off in the second
yes.
one.
Yes.
But, yeah, sorry, go ahead.
So aside from that, Stroman looked pretty good yesterday. Walker looked fantastic today. I mean, 7 innings, 8 strikeouts, 1 hit, no walks. Against a team that, I mean, the Cardinals aren't great, but the Cardinals are clearly the class of that division. So for him to shut down that lineup like that was impressive. You know, I think that Peterson has been about what you expect, maybe even a little bit better than you expect. And, you know, Yamamoto looked good in his limited role yesterday. The Mets pitching is just, it's working right now. This transitions nicely into our next topic, which is just this idea of the onslaught of injuries and injury news we've received. So Jacob DeGrom was scratched from his Tuesday start due to a tightness in his right lat. He appears to be okay. They're hoping he will pitch maybe Sunday. You know, and that's not the end of the world for him to skip a start. It happens to DeGrom almost every year that he manages to get one start where he's slightly hurt everyone panics, and then he wins a Cy Young. So I'm not totally concerned about that. But we heard today that Carlos Carrasco either suffered a setback or is recovering slower than the Mets hoped, because they transferred him to the 60-day IL today, which means he cannot come off until the end of May. I believe it's May 30th or 31st is the first date he'd be available. And there's sort of some conflicting information out there. I know you and I were speaking off mic before about how there's a big difference between a setback and just being slower in how you are recovering. And it's somewhat unclear as to which of those is going on now. Although I will say that Carrasco was scratched from his weekend start, so maybe something did happen. But it doesn't appear to be super major. But now Syndergaard and Seth Lugo and Carrasco are all set to come off the IL at around the same time, approximately. And if the Mets can sustain what they're doing right now until the end of May, and even two-thirds of those guys come back around that time, another guy a few weeks later, that's going to be a huge shot in the arm for the team. Just absolutely massive. But are you particularly worried about DeGrom or Carrasco?
No, not yet. And it would take a significant update to get me there. And like you said, with DeGrom, the fact that he wasn't hurting that bad, had the MRI, nothing's torn, some inflammation, but everything looked okay there. I don't know. I think he's going to be fine. If he doesn't make the start on Sunday, I'm also not going to panic over it. I just think they had an opportunity to put him on the IL and not have him really miss much more time than he's missing anyway.
That's the rub, right? With this team, they just don't know how to use the IL ever.
Yeah, no, and it's... I mean, I guess on some level I get it. Okay, Nimmo has been one of their best hitters for the past few years and one of the few hitters who's really had a good start. But between his hip thing and then the fact that he, had the finger injury on Saturday night, that I don't know. It was just like not very realistic to me to expect that he could get up there and swing a bat and be himself. Just give him the 10 days. But I get that temptation on some level to say, well, the best pitcher there is, and one of the few hitters who's hitting well for us. Like, well, what if he feels better in 48 hours? I don't want to miss 8 days of that. I understand that, but like once you get to a certain point, the timing with Nimmo, putting him on the IL between games of the doubleheader.
Between games of the doubleheader, yeah.
Which is the most ridiculous thing. Like, either he was ready to play baseball in the morning or he wasn't. I know you get the 27th man. I know with the stupid extra inning rule that your bench isn't prone to being tested or exposed to the point that you run out of pinch hitters. I know all that, but it's just like if he couldn't play the first game, why was he active for the first game? It just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it's dumb. It's real dumb.
but yeah, I mean, I don't know. On the pitching side of things, as long as they, as long as it's kind of just status quo, if there's a little bit of a delay, I'm not too worried. If there's a major delay, like Carrasco, it's 2.5-3 weeks difference from when we may have expected him to pitch a game. So that's, some time, but it's not 2 or 3 months different.
Right.
Could be at some point, but right now it isn't. So
I forget if it was Keith or Gary on the broadcast today who said, the goal is to get Carrasco back for the rest of the season. So if that means making him wait a couple of weeks to make sure he's really healthy and really back to his fighting shape, that's better than having him come back earlier and then having to go back on the IL. So I am sympathetic to them holding him off a little bit longer. I'm not particularly worried either, nor am I particularly worried about Brandon Nimmo or J.D. Davis. With Nimmo, I feel like with the hip thing, he didn't look right the couple of games he played after the initial flare-up of the hip before he hurt his finger. And I feel like baseball teams still kind of operate as if it's a 15-day DL instead of the 10-day IL, because while I'm certainly not saying that that there's any reason to rush a player onto the injured list, it just seems to me like if you're going to be thinking about it logically, when Nimmo went down, when did he get scratched with the hip injury? Was that was last week, wasn't it? That was last Tuesday or Wednesday?
Yeah, I think it was early in the week. That sounds right.
So he'd if they put him on the IL, then he'd be coming off tomorrow or Saturday. Nothing that DeGrom did in between him having the initial hip issue and actually going on the IL, he did nothing to really help the team win. So what are you doing this for? Why are you? It just seems to me 10 days is such a little amount of time. There's no reason to possibly risk it when you know he'll be back in a week and a half, especially because he sat for a couple of days. So you could have even done the whole retroactive IL thing where you say, he was retroactive to whatever the last day he played was. There's just no reason for it. I don't understand what it is about the Mets not using the IL properly. Are you worried about Davis at all?
No. I don't know. Maybe a little, but no. By the same logic as all the other guys, there's not anything on the table that's like potential surgery, long-term absence, that kind of thing. So the only thing I'm worried about with him is his defense at third base, which will be a roller coaster. But hey, if he hits like Mike Trout, I think I could live with it.
You think?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hey, he's got a 197 weighted runs created plus right now. So that's not 2021 Mike Trout, but that's like normal Mike Trout.
Right.
Just for the record, 2021 Mike Trout is at 251 in that metric right now.
And yet he's never talked about. I don't understand it. I don't know why every SportsCenter broadcast doesn't begin with, "Hey, look what Mike Trout did today," because it's almost always amazing.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's a conversation for a different day. The last bit we want to talk about before getting to our music picks was the end of the Francisco Lindor hitting drought happened today. Lindor reached base a couple of times via the walk, but then in his last at bat of the night, the day rather, he stroked a single into right field and appears to be maybe, and I'm saying this very hesitantly, maybe coming out of this extended slump that he was in. I think it's a little bit early to say he's coming out of it, but I think that him taking drawing three walks today and getting the single, it shows that there is some improvement, hopefully, happening for Lindor. Do you feel, and I think both of us were in the same position where we didn't necessarily think that this was going to be indicative of his entire season, or as I heard someone say the other day, his entire Mets career. I think we were both relatively calm about it, but it is nice to see him breaking out of that.
Yeah, and I think he put a good swing on the ball. It was just an out to center field. It wasn't the best anybody's ever hit a baseball or anything, but he drove a ball that a little bit to left, a little bit to right would have easily been a double. And obviously those kinds of things happen all the time in baseball, and a lot of times they turn into outs. So, it was an out, but it was just nice, solid contact. And then, you know, as you said, he drew some walks and then he got the hit, just a single. But it's one thing to be struggling where your overall line isn't up to your standards. It's another one to be 0 for 20 something. I think that both things can make you press, but I think 0 for 24 can really start to mess with you. So, you know, he had a productive day at the plate, even though his only hit was a single. And it really is just a matter of time, I think, until he's kind of lighting things up. And, you know, when he's doing that and playing defense and being the joyous presence and leader that he is on this team, I think the concept of anybody booing him, I know he'll get booed again if he goes into a slump ever, because that's
what fans do.
Yeah. But the idea that people were feeling like self-righteous about booing him in April of the first year of his contract, like, I just hope those people feel dumb at some point.
So I ran into a guy earlier this week, and I'm not going to say his name in case I can't imagine he would ever listen to this, but regardless. And we were talking about just the Mets in general and Lindor. And he said, you know, I said, you know, Lindor's had some rough stretches in his career before. And, you know, I'm not worried about this. This isn't going to be his entire career. And the guy looked me like dead in the eye and seriously was like, but what if it is, bro? And I just said to be like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Even if he went hitless from the start of the season to now, do you really think that 20-something games is going to be indicative of someone's entire career? Someone's the next 10 years of an elite baseball player's career? I mean, I know that people have fallen off a cliff before. I know that's a reality that has happened to ball players, but it seems like to happen to a guy at his age and his skill level just seemed utterly preposterous, especially because he raked in spring training.
Right.
We saw him have success already. You know, it's fake success, right? Spring training doesn't matter, but he didn't look washed in spring training.
Right, you know? No.
I mean, Betances looked washed in spring training. So when he looked terrible in the regular season, it was not a surprise to anyone. This is not that situation.
Yeah, that, as we transition to music picks here in a second, just that interaction reminds me, and I think I've told you this story, but probably not on the show. Wilco had a small festival down in Mexico at the very beginning of 2020, which feels like it was 10 years ago. And after they played three sets and they had one night off, and, you know, the four nights of it. And I think it was the afternoon after their second set, and I'm in the water enjoying being in Mexico, enjoying the whole thing, and just, you know, randomly chatting with another person who's there. And they went into this whole thing about like how Pat, one of the guys in the band, for anybody who's not familiar, he looks so unhappy up there. Like, I don't think he wants to be in the band anymore. And like, the same reaction you had with this guy with Lindor, where I was just like, what, like, are we observing, what planet are you on right now? Like, right. I just don't, I can't wrap my head around conclusions that fans can jump to that just don't make any logical sense, or just draw, you know, upon information that they do not have. I don't understand it. So like that, I was as baffled as you were. So that guy makes me think of the guy that I talked to.
I mean, to be fair, I think Pat smiles the least of anyone on stage, but that's sure, always how he is.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's, I don't know. There's just something about fandom that can make people think irrational things.
Yes. So I feel like our message every week is basically just, we are the Mets equivalent of a keep calm and carry on sign. But truly, you know, the Mets are doing it right. without them firing on all cylinders, with important players on the IL, and with zero run support for some amazing starting pitching. So when things start to click a little bit more, they'll be fine. Don't worry, folks. Chris, what is your music pick for this week?
So I think I've recommended at least one record by the band Wand before, and there's this whole like network of bands out in California that, you know, so and so is in this band and that band, and like they're the front person in one band, and they're just a musician in another.
By the way, Chris, you're not going to believe this. You have recommended Wand twice, but it's been the same record both times.
Did I?
Yes. I don't know how that happened. I usually try and keep track of this stuff, but
all right. Yeah. Well,
you recommended Laughing Matter on episodes 18 and 39.
Jeez, that's not that far apart.
Well, you gotta realize that was like we were not doing every week last season.
Right. Right. Yeah.
So this is probably somewhat. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. No. Well, this is not the same record. Corey Hansen is the lead vocalist, lead guitarist, really lead everything in Wand, and he put out a solo record called Pale Horse Rider. It's got a lot of like countryish sounds in it. It's very calm. It was recommended to me as a good rainy day record, and I think that is a good context for listening to it. Similar enough that if anybody did take my recommendation on either of those occasions, that I would naturally think that they would also like this. But I could see some people out there, whether it's listeners or friends of mine who might not really get into Wand, who could listen to this record and love it a lot. So yeah, it's a cool, like the elements of what go into his songs with the band are there, but it's a very different expression of that. If only because of the instruments and effects or lack thereof, that are used on him. But yeah, it came out, I think just, 2-3 weeks ago, or something like that. And I'd missed it until somebody else mentioned it and finally gave it a proper listen this week. And now it's my recommendation.
Very nice. I like the Wand records you recommended in the past. I thought there were two. I really did. Maybe my bookkeeping is wrong, but I don't know. But so I'll have to check this out because that sounds pretty much up my alley. So I made a decision a few weeks ago that I was going to try to go as long as I could without recommending a band that was made up of white guys playing guitar. So last week I picked a Brazilian record, and this week I'm going after a film soundtrack, film score, technically. One of my favorite movies is the film about the Watergate investigation, All the President's Men. I think it's just a fantastic film. And the last time I watched it, I was really taken by the score, which is unbelievably mellow and underplayed. Like there's not a lot of movement to it. It's these like long, sort of drawn out, almost arpeggios played by a brass section, but just like really, it just sets a mood. There's not a ton of melody, and it's something that I sort of kept coming back to over the last few months when I would be thinking about music I wanted to listen to, and it's not on any streaming services. It's on YouTube, so I'll link it in YouTube. But the soundtrack was apparently only released as like a pairing with another film, and that's out of print now. And it's by a guy named Michael Shire, who did The Conversation, which is another fantastic score. That's a very piano-based score, whereas this is very brass-heavy. But both of them are just these sort of hypnotic, slow, thoughtful, meditation-like soundtracks, and it's something that I don't like. I never thought that would be stuff that I would be reaching for in my music listening, but I've been really feeling it a lot lately. And so like I said, if you I think even if you've seen the film, the score might not have stuck with you, because it's not like, you know, when you get a John Williams score, like, I think you can stop a person on the street and be like, hey, how does the Jurassic Park theme go? And they could probably tell you. Or the Indiana Jones theme or the Star Wars theme. This does not have any theme like that. It's just this very, very moody, pretty quiet, but really, I think, beautiful and interesting music. So that's my pick. Michael Shire's score to All the President's Men.
Nice.
Yeah. I just realized that I tend to pick a lot of just white guys with guitars. I think as we all do, but I want to be better than that every now and then and just present something different. Because I try to listen to different sorts of stuff. I really do. Anyway, we've talked about this in the past. I'd be really curious to see if anybody who listens to the show checks out our record recommendation. So if you do, tweet at us. We'd love to hear about it. And thank you all for listening. We appreciate that as well. Please go to AmazingAvenue.com. Check out all the stuff we have going on. Now that the minor league season is happening, we have daily minor league updates. We have game recaps, news, analysis, all sorts of stuff for you there. You can also find the site on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Amazing Avenue. You can find this show on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, on Stitcher, wherever you get podcasts. Please rate, review, and subscribe. That helps more folks find out about the show. You can follow Chris on Twitter at Chris McShane. You can follow me on Twitter at Brian Is an App. And until next time, keep calm and let's go Mets.